Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
The cover of God Save the Fan, a new book by Will Leach, features a big foam hand with an extended middle finger. The significance of that image would seem to be unmistakable, but for those who miss it, the subtitle of the book is How Preening Sportscasters, Athletes Who Speak in the Third Person, and the Occasional Convicted Quarterback Have Taken the Fun Out of Sports and How We Can Get It Back. This week, when I had the opportunity to speak with Will Leach, who also writes the blog Deadspin, I began by congratulating him on the length of the subtitle of his book and asking him how the preening sportscasters et al. Had taken the fun out of sports for him.
Well, I think there's a certain corporatization that's kind of happened to sports a little bit, where the separation between those that work in the world of sports and the people that actually, you know, consume the sports, the people that pay for all of this, I think that gap has widened, I think, in the last 10, 15 years. And I don't think it's solely the fault of ESPN, though. I think them being as large as they have, as they've contributed to it a lot. But if any other business ran their business the way that I think the world of sports ran their business, I think they'd be out of business.
Quite early in God Save the Fan, you write, athletes are not connected to the world around them because they don't have to be. And I'll go along with you as far as some of the multimillion-dollar players of baseball, basketball, and football, et cetera, are concerned. But how far down the chain does that generalization hold?
One of the jokes I make in the book is the idea that in a lot of ways athletes are almost piano prodigies that can jump. Very, very early on, their talent is often noticed and they are separated. I think that's why I get frustrated a lot of times when I think people will try to accuse athletes, oh, they're bad people, or they're thugs, or they're arrogant. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. I just think in a lot of ways they really have not been forced to maybe play by the same rules that the rest of us do, because they've been told from a very early age, you're special, you're different. And I think that naturally leads, particularly when you come to that larger level of professional sports, even very high-profile college sports, I think you do see a separation. And so I'm not sure it's necessarily always their fault. In fact, it's probably more ours than anyone else's.
You contend that, quote, deep down, most fans don't care whether athletes take steroids or human growth hormone. This, of course, has been a big
yes.
issue lately. What's the basis of that conclusion regarding most fans?
Well, because I think that, you know, when the stories initially came out, I think there was a lot of feeling almost betrayed and a lot of frustration with that. But this has been going on for so long now. Certainly, if you look at the Clemens steroid hearings, remember, initially that was supposed to be about getting to the bottom of the steroid mess. So people always forget that before Rafael Palmeiro and Mark McGwire and so on testified, before that they had a woman whose son had killed himself, mm-hmm. which she believed to have something to do with his steroid abuse. And that was the initial idea of all those hearings. Now it appears to be Congress was almost mediating a divorce between a player and his trainer in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think fans are better at putting things in perspective, and certainly you hope that your favorite player is on steroids. I think everyone would prefer to have nobody on steroids, but I think when you work in sports, everything's a little bit more important in the world of sports, and steroids is this huge story that you're trying to crack or try to get to the bottom of. I don't mean to say that there's not still outrage involved in this situation, but there's a certain helplessness, and you realize still at this point we're still talking about steroid abuse from like 10 years ago. Like if you look at the Mitchell report, I did a story where I interviewed the Bob Bowman, the head of MLB.com, and he talked about how the day the Mitchell report came out, they had 7 million downloads of the Mitchell report. 3 days later, they had six. Not 6 million, six actual downloads. And I think that's actually pretty telling, actually. You look for that initial news item, and you're like, okay, and then you kind of move on, because it's the only way to kind of stay sane as a sports fan.
Of the exhibitionist who takes off his shirt during a football game played in freezing weather to reveal one of the letters of ESPN on his chest, you write, this is not the typical sports fan. What is the typical sports fan, and how did you decide what the typical sports fan is?
Well, one of the things that's been very exciting for me about doing Deadspin is realizing that the average sports fan is the average American. They're often very professional. They work, one of the ongoing jokes we have on the site is the Deadspin LLP. Whenever there's a legal issue, I'll call it out to the commenters of Deadspin LLP. So now you know exactly where all your billable hours are going. They're going to read blogs and comment on blogs. And a lot of times when people work in sports, the only time they ever really come in contact with the people that, just the average hardcore sports fans, are either when they're sending them angry emails, they're listening to talk radio, or they're seeing those cameras at the games with the guys with the ESPN pin on their chest. I think the average sports fan is much more intelligent than that, and I think that that's kind of a stereotype of fans. I remember when ESPN Magazine did their recent story of the fans issue. I think ESPN Magazine is actually a pretty good magazine, but I remember when they...
Is that going to come back to bite you? I mean, you're making a career out of attacking ESPN,
you know,
my friend.
I think, well, we can get to that in a moment, but I remember when they talked about the idea of having the fan issue. I'm like, you know what? I bet the cover is going to be a shirtless guy that's tubby, screaming into the camera. And you know, I have tons of friends that are sports fans. I've literally never met any of those people. I'm not sure that's really indicative of what fans actually are. They're Americans like everybody else.
Well, elsewhere in the book, you maintain that, quote, being a sports fan means investing a ludicrous amount of time and mental energy into something that bears no relevance to real life. Is there no such thing as a healthy person who is also a fan? Because that sounds like an unhealthy obsession to me, way you've defined it.
But see, I actually think that's actually healthier. I think that, like, it's understanding that, like, this is entertainment. I can't think of anything else in the world that will make me spontaneously jump up and just start screaming, except for maybe a spider. And I think that...
you can't count on them.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't have schedules.
I know. They never go into extra innings, spiders, either. And there's something, one of the wonderful things about sports, and I think fans are better at keeping that in perspective than I think they're given credit for. I think you become obsessed for a certain period of time, and then you go back to your life. And I think the reason the obsession happens is because it is escapism. It is entertainment. It's something you can kind of dip into, enjoy, and then step away and go back to your life, which I think is another reason there's a little bit of a separation sometimes between the people that work full-time in the world of sports and the people that actually consume the sports.
Does the typical sports fan hate the Olympics, or is that just you?
I might dislike them more than the average fan, but I do think that there's just something somewhat archaic almost about the Olympics anymore. Certainly the last Summer Olympics, when essentially we were being asked to ignore the internet during the day.
And because we weren't supposed to know who won.
We weren't supposed to know what happened. So we were basically getting glorified highlight packages told as if they were real and stopped in the middle with one of those soft-focused, dramatic, hero worship type of pieces. And another thing I find kind of interesting is that as Americans, we love underdogs. I think it's very core to our being as we love to root for the scrappy underdogs. In the Olympics, Americans are never the underdogs.
Well, in only selective sports.
Yes, yes. And
they're never on TV.
Yeah. Or we invent a sport that we're really good at, and all of a sudden, hey, the half pipe is now an Olympic sport.
Absolutely.
And I feel like maybe as Americans we should go ahead and say, we have everything else. You guys can have the luge.
Well, I understand your objections to the Olympic Games. They're political, they're commercial. The U.S. has packed them with sports that athletes from this country can win. There's no question about that. Still, some fans can put all that aside and enjoy the athleticism of the competitors. You, on the other hand, say that you're only thrilled when a figure skater falls down. What is wrong with you?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably my more personal thing. I think that, like, the Olympics is going to have to change a little bit in the next coming years. Because I think most enjoyment, I get some enjoyment from the Olympics too, but I think it's mostly almost for nostalgia purposes. We all remember the great 84 Olympics, and it was a very strange thing during the Winter Olympics in 2006 to pretty much have to pretend when you were watching the Olympics that you didn't actually know what happened. And it's something that when you think of the great moments in Olympic history, of course being the Miracle on Ice being a great example of that, I mean, that's something that wouldn't happen now. We would already know what happened, and that big drama wouldn't be there. And I think that's in a way why they're a little bit almost a relic in a lot of ways, an enjoyable relic in some ways, but I think maybe not necessarily the way people consume sports now.
Well, you're certainly backing off your contention that you're only thrilled when a figure skater falls down.
I do love it when a figure skater falls. I'm not going to lie to you. As someone that I will confess not getting a large part of enjoyment of the beauty of figure skating, the falling down I do find kind of amusing.
In the introduction to God Save the Fan, you say fans just have to, quote, take charge and realize our power. It's almost a call to arms. But at the end of the book, you write that we should just see sports as a respite from life's unpleasant aspects and enjoy sports for what they are. Have you given up by the end of the book, or is there a conflict here?
It took a long time to write it. I lost all my spirit. But by the end, I was like, okay, is this thing over? And I think that
how many pages do I have to give these people?
I think you could actually have both. Actually, I think a great example of fans actually having a little bit of power is actually what you saw in the last week of the season with the Giants and the Patriots in the NFL Network game. Mm-hmm. Like, I think 5 years ago, the NFL Network, if it had it existed, would have never, like, that game would have just been on the NFL Network, and there's nothing anyone could have done about it. Now fans, like, it's easier for fans. I wouldn't say mobilize. I don't think like the protests and so on work so much, but it's easier for when there's a collective scream of, hey, what are you guys
doing?
Hey,
we want to see this game.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like that's a lot easier to be heard than I think it used to be, and to me, that's kind of what I mean in that idea, and that's actually born of the idea of loving sports and enjoying them for what they are. It always seems very backwards to me when networks will make their games harder to be seen, make their product less available in a lot of ways. As a kid, I grew up watching the St. Louis Cardinals games all the time for free, and I assure you, they've certainly got their money's worth out of me over the last couple decades.
You expend a good deal of energy banging on ESPN, which is okay, I guess, except that one of the chapters in the book is titled Five People Who Offended the Almighty ESPN and Paid the Price. Aren't you afraid that you'll be squashed like a bug?
I'm not too worried about that because, I think Deadspin's been able to get bigger and the book has been doing okay, but let's not pretend. Like, on my best day, I have 1/1,000th of the traffic and readership that ESPN does. And I think that's actually kind of the thing about ESPN. I don't think that, like, there's so much malicious or actively trying to ruin sports. I think what's kind of what happened is I, like any other sports fan, watch ESPN regularly because there's really no real viable competitor. They have me. I'm not going anywhere. So because of that, you know, they're a corporation. They have to grow. It's not an art project. You know, I certainly understand that. But to grow, they have to kind of go after the more casual fan. So there's inevitable kind of dumbing down or pumping up controversy or making everything kind of a black or white issue in a lot of ways. And I think it's pretty natural for those of us that remember the golden days of ESPN when it was really like Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick and Craig Kilborn, and we remember like how it was so fresh and really like we were like, wow, this is such a cool new way to work at sports and how exciting that was. And as they've gotten away from that, I think in recent years, I think it's natural that, you know, your most loyal customers are going to have a little bit of a backlash involving that.
Will Leach is the author of God Save the Fan, published by Harper, and he also writes the blog Deadspin, at least until ESPN notices him and crushes him like a bug. Will, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My conversation with Will Leach will be featured on Saturday's program. I'll also be talking with Tim Kirkjian about which Major League Baseball teams have improved themselves since October and whether any team is likely to provide Barry Bonds with employment this spring. We'll have a story about skiers who've discovered that less is more in terms of smaller mountains and resorts that have scaled back on glitz, and I'll visit with the number one Division II men's basketball team in the nation, the Bentley College Falcons, who seem poised to soar to a second straight undefeated regular season. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.